Hello and welcome to the Echo Chamber podcast. Well, is it the Echo Chamber podcast? I'm not sure anymore. I'm really not sure about it today. Today I am joined by the host of the Mick Clifford podcast, Mick Clifford himself, the Irish Examiner special correspondent. Mick, how are you keeping?
Not too bad, Tony. Sure, hanging in there, as they say, you know.
It's another strange one where we're supposed to be hosting this, and we are talking to two individuals who come at this aspect from the same point of view, but may have two different solutions. We're joined by Unite Trade Union member and again friend of the pod, Brendan Ogle, and former podcast co-host Martin McMahon. Hey,
good morning, Mr. Groves. How are you?
I'm good. Listen, lads. Brendan, can I go to you first, if you don't mind? That we have spoken on air, off air, and across the months now on the work and what's going on in terms of bogus self-employment. As a trade unionist, as a proud trade unionist, can you explain your position in that capacity? And then maybe we'll go to Martin and we'll find out where do we differ.
Yeah, absolutely. Unite Trade Union, and I suppose trade unions generally, I hope, view this in the wider context. Obviously, there's a bogus self-employment scandal. I'd go so far as to call it a fraud taking place in Ireland. But just to put that in a wider context, this is linked to the international drive to drive down the cost of labour. And Chomsky, in his book, Understanding Power, his most recent version of that book, published in 2018, says that the driving down of labor costs by taking away employer costs is actually a bigger threat to society than automation. And it has to be seen in that context, because what bogus self-employment does is it does what capital is doing internationally. It divorces the obligation of capital to meet what traditionally would have been costs associated with labor. And it seeks to pass those costs on somewhere else. Now, the somewhere else can be, you know, on the state pension fund, on the social security fund, on the money the revenue collects that should be going in to provide social services. But it's an international phenomenon, and it's a growing international phenomenon in what I call the post-democratic period of neoliberalism. I link it, the Irish bit, to that infamous or famous, I think the right think it's famous, the left think it's infamous, boast of former Taoiseach Enda Kenny in 2002 that Ireland was the best small country in the world to do business. Now, if you take that sentence, and if you look at it from the point of view of somebody who wants to do business, of course, it's a positive thing. We all want to be a good place to do business. We all want jobs. We all want the economy to be vibrant. We want to have full employment, and we want everything to be booming. If you think about what it actually means, though, if you think about what message it sends to employers, and we know that the economy relies disproportionately on foreign direct investment. So if you think about what message it sends, it's telling them that the costs that you may have to pay elsewhere, you know, we have a different approach in Ireland. We know that they have a different approach to corporation tax, and I'm suggesting that one of the things they have a different approach to, because I don't think Martin Sterling, amazing work in this area, he stumbled across an accident here. I think he has exposed and has been exposing a deliberate fraud on the revenue and the taxpayers, which the revenue are part of, by the way, which is part of this push to get business in. Because if employers don't have to meet their costs, if they don't have to meet costs of paying social security, of paying pensions...
Yeah, Brendan, I don't mean to... I know, look, we've had a good run, and I understand what we're getting at, but I mean, the majority of our listeners will understand the concept of what this means and what it means in the detriment to, say, pension pots and resources for people and how it cuts employers. You know, in effect, we would call it, I think the EU Competition Authority called some of this stuff almost like illegal state aid when you give these kind of breaches. But what I'm asking you, I suppose, in a nutshell, is what are you proposing? To to combat it with?
Well, yeah, I hope the listeners do think that, Tony. I don't think they do. I think the general public certainly don't. Maybe your listeners are more informed than the general public, but I think the general public have no idea of the fraud that's been committed on them. None whatsoever, or its implications. But you're right to move it. You're right to try to move the discussion into the solution space, because this has been going on now for decades. And, you know, there is a review. I don't believe it's a real review. I believe I've got evidence on my screen in front of me to prove it's not a real review. So what we need here is we need some sort of legally enforceable way to define the difference between an employee and a self-employed person, or a bogus self-employed person, to define the difference between a contract for service and a contract of service. And we need it to be legally enforceable. And we need, once we have a legally enforceable means to measure that, we then need workers to be able to access free, at no cost to themselves, to be able to access free remedies where they find themselves wrongly on the wrong side of that dividing line between a contract for service and a contract of services. So that's two big changes. At the moment, there's no legally enforceable mechanism. At the moment, there's no real free enforceability. And the third thing we want to do is to reverse the burden. The burden of proof at the moment, if a worker is deemed to be, we call them bogus self-employed, is on the worker to prove otherwise.
Just going to interrupt the podcast here. Look, we're looking for money again. We have to do this. This is how we survive. And I just want to say, we have great days too, Tony. We do have great days. Rory had a great day about housing. You had a great day on finance. I'm having a good time on bogus self-employment. So we do a lot of other work as well. It's important that we keep this podcast going. It's our direct line to be able to highlight subjects we think are important to the public.
I think that is it in a nutshell. It's like when you see the volume of people engaged. Rory's piece, Rory had one over on me. I said to him, Rory, you've been writing that since 2013. And he said, I know. And I was writing 2013 and I'm right today. So yeah,
20 years to be an overnight success, Tony.
Yeah, this is it though. And this is the reality. But without the tortoise shack, does that happen, Martin? Without that agency, without that platform, without that bit of clout that we have, you know, like, I mean, there are radio stations that would give their hands for the sort of listenership we have. And yet it's not viable.
And we can't stick all those ads in like a radio does too, Tony. We have to be careful.
Would you advertise with us if you thought that we were going to be anti-investment and anti-capital, anti-vulture fund? That's where, like, you think all these other, there's radio stations that go from discussion on banks and then into an advert for Be With AIB, you know, sponsored by. So, you know, like, I don't care what you say. The quiet hand of editorial control comes in many forms, and we don't want ads.
There's no editorial control here, Tony. There's no quiet hand.
No, absolutely not. And we shouldn't have it. But we do need you, as our listener, to go to patreon.com/tortoiseshack. There's a range of options there. It's from the price of a cup of coffee up to a couple of quid. And you know what? There's loads of benefits as well. We will be live on Sunday. You get to come along, have a bit of crack. And there's other things going on. But just help us out. Thanks very much. And we will go back to the podcast now and enjoy it.
Hold on before you do that, Tony. It's patreon.com/tortoiseshack.
The burden of proof at the moment, if a worker is deemed to be, we call them bogus self-employed, is on the worker to prove otherwise. And sometimes the only choice, after going through a committee here and there, the only choice to get real enforceability of a wrong decision is for the worker to take a case, a judicial review possibly, or to take a case to the High Court to seek to overturn a decision of the Appeals Committee, the Department of Social Welfare Appeals Committee, at the employee's own cost. We need to reverse that burden. And then we need the final part of it, Tony. We need a real enforceability on employers that are found to have been doing wrongdoing. We need to strip away this nonsense where if you don't make a complaint within 6 months, what statute of limitations, apart from unemployees, provides for 6 months? We need to strip away where if you don't make a complaint within 6 months, you don't have a complaint. We suggest 6 years. And you need to have punitive enforcement mechanisms on employers who are found to fall foul, not just to go and take a whole lot of money off them, but to discourage the behaviour in the first place, because that's what punitive penalties will do. And they aren't, there aren't punitive penalties. There is a situation at the moment where even if an employer is by some miracle found to have acted badly in this respect, it's nearly, they're nearly better off to be found and acted badly financially, because they can save more money by not paying, by not properly treating the employee as an employee, than the penalty that they'll face down the line. So it really is, from an employer's point of view, Tony, the best small country in the world to do business. And no surprise it is.
Martin, just one element that Brendan touched on there, and it strikes me goes to the heart of a lot of the problems in this country, and that is the method or the route of any type of decision or resolution as to whether or not somebody is self-employed on a bogus basis. And that is done on, in secret. It's done within an agency of the department. And the appeal process is also one that is shrouded in secrecy. Again, and another issue that arises there is very little evidence. In fact, there's a lot of evidence to the contrary, that in coming to their decisions, they do not use legal precedent that has been, law that has been effectively judge made in previous cases. That whole area, if that alone was fixed, surely a lot of the behaviour and the mechanisms that Brendan referenced there could be sorted out. If there, if, as it is, it seems to be carrying on with impunity. If there's a proper process, then eventually the whole system should be ironed out, I would have thought.
I'd agree with you on that, Mick. The problem at the moment, and it came up very recently in the WRC judgment, everything is done in secret. No statements are taken. It's too close. There's not enough independence between the Department of Social Welfare and the Social Welfare Appeals Office. In fact, there's no independence. And all of these issues came up in the WRC ruling. So my argument has always been, as somebody who's been in there, I think more than anybody else has been in there, I think I've been in there 19 times, it astounds me that it's been allowed to continue for so long. You have to actually be in it to understand how utterly outrageous the whole thing is. My solution is take the state out of it, because the state is completely corrupt on this. And there's no fixing it. You cannot fix revenue, you cannot fix social welfare, you cannot fix the Department of Finance to deal with this properly. They've been doing it wrong for so long, deliberately wrong for so long, that you can't fix it. Now, what the state has done, or what the political setup has done, is taken it upon themselves to overrule the higher courts. And that's what they're doing. They get a judgment from a court that says this worker is an employee and not self-employed. Well, say it goes to the all the way to the High Court. The state is only using that as a kicking off point for negotiations. They're not saying that as the final word. Martin, and it is the final word.
Martin, sorry, just to rewind the tape back a few seconds. Asking the state to step away out of it. I'm going to say it sounds like pie in the sky stuff to me.
But it's not their purview anyway. It's not up to them anyway. It's up to the courts. This is a matter of law. This is not a matter of politics or what's politically expedient, which is what they've turned it into.
Their recommendation was that the Code of Practice for Self-Determined Self-Employment is updated and placed on a statutory footing as stated by the Department of Social Protection without delay.
Okay, so first of all, you have to ask, what is the Code of Practice? Well, the Code of Practice is a tick box exercise which came about, which was published in 2001, a copy of which was sent to me by the Public Accounts Committee in 2001. And what the Public Accounts Committee told me about the group that came up with this, and this is on record, this is 100%, that the group only exists because I told the Department of Social Welfare that they shouldn't be using test cases, and that the group discussed my case while it was sub judice. So the entire Code of Practice is a ball of smoke.
Is it also the case that the Code of Practice is not in a statutory footing? It's not actually in law.
No, and it's not in law. And I don't actually see any purpose in putting it in law because it's not what the law says about how you determine employment status. It's nothing to do with what the law says.
Go ahead, Brendan. Yeah.
Yeah, I think this is the fundamental, the kernel of the matter. So, first of all, Martin is correct. The code of practice, and I don't even like using that term for it. The code of practice that is being used at the moment is not what should be considered a code of practice. And I have no problem agreeing with Martin in his description of it as a ball of smoke. A ball of smoke, a piece of hot air, words on a piece of paper, useless. And he is also correct in that it fails to take account of proven and decided legal principles and judgments in this area. He's 100% correct about that. Where I a small disagreement with Mark is that that can't be fixed. And that putting a code of practice on a statutory footing doesn't fix it. I believe it does. I'm not talking, I want to be very clear here, I'm not talking about putting the existing code of practice on a statutory footing. The existing code of practice should be put in a shredder. That's the only place for the existing code of practice. But there's a process that goes behind putting in place a statutory code of practice before a minister signs off on it. And a minister signs a statutory code of practice. No minister is going to sign a statutory code of practice or would be allowed to sign a statutory code of practice that doesn't take on board the key principles and court judgments that already exist. I've got one beside me. There are many. I've got one beside me. It's a case that me and Martin have spoken about before. It's a judgment of the High Court on this area in 2002 against six workers who worked as contract meter readers, as they were called, for ESB at the time. And the judgment by Justice Gilligan sets down things like the control test, things like the entrepreneurial test, for example. For example, you know, I spoke to Mike before about this. Mick's a journalist. I don't know if he's a freelance. I don't know if he's full time. It doesn't matter. There are lots of freelance journalists. Does a freelance journalist have the freedom to go out and drive a taxi and come back to his journalism later in the day or not? The courts have decided that that's a key way of measuring whether the journalist is employed or self-employed.
Are you sure about that, Brendan? Sorry, are you sure about that to the extent? No, to this extent. What you might be talking about there is going across sectors. If you were to use that analogy of the freelance, I'm not freelance month, I was at one stage. Would that not be a freelance journalist working for different organisations at the same time?
Well, you could have a number of different jobs and you could have a number of different PRSI numbers.
You could be across, yeah.
I'm not trying to make this about journalism. It just happened.
Well, I know that. I know. I'm just talking about sectors.
There are tests. That's the entrepreneurial test. There are tests set down in court, which are not being applied by use of the bogus code of practice that Martin refers to, the ball of smoke, which I agree with. Right? And if the department were required, Department of Social Protection were required to set down a statutory code of practice, they would have to go through the case law, they would have to go through the legal principles, and they would have to design a code of practice to comply with that. Otherwise, it'd be a judicial review into the High Court, and the courts would fix it for them.
Can I say one quick thing there?
Please, before you do, because this is very important. I know that despite what you read earlier, Tony, and despite what Martin says, and despite what I say, and despite what was said at the Public Accounts Committee, and despite the fact that what I'm saying is so obvious, let's have a statutory code of practice. I know that's not the plan. Because I have on the screen in front of me here, from the Assistant General Secretary from the Department of Social Protection, on the 22nd of April, Mr. Tim Duggan, his proposed solution. So the Assistant Secretary General of the Department, after Martin exposing all of this, has sent a draft code of practice, and it's not a statutory code of practice. The reason why it's not a statutory code of practice is because they know a statutory code of practice won't allow them to do what they're doing now.
One quick thing, I think, and both of you addressed this, where it seems to me, and you'd know better, that there's an issue in this country. Recently, we had superior court judgments in Holland and in the UK in relation to bogus self-employment. And certainly in terms of the reporting in both instances, they suggested that because of those cases, there will be major changes in those countries in relation to bogus self-employment. Yet it seems in this country, despite previous serious judgments, one of which Brendan referred to there, and there was others go back to Denny, and there's been others since, despite that, it doesn't seem to change. It's nearly as if the whole situation is operating in a totally different sphere from the law of the land as determined by the courts.
And you're completely right. And this is my whole thing. Like, if you compare what the committee has proposed, the committee has said that they'd like to bring gig workers into the code of practice. Well, gig workers were never left out in the first place. Gig workers are covered by the law that already exists. There is no definition of a gig worker in law. You can't say that worker is a gig worker. It's such utter nonsense to say we'll bring them into the fold now. They've been in the fold all along. You've just been ignoring them. And this is why I am against a code of practice. The best way, the quickest way, the most efficient way to sort this out is let scope section make the determinations, the initial determinations. And then if either party wants to appeal, and it's generally the employer who wants to appeal, then you appeal it to the circuit court. The employer carries the expenses, not the worker. The worker is only a notice party. The Minister for Social Welfare is the defendant. So therefore, you've satisfied everything you need to satisfy. The worker isn't being dragged in and faced with huge legal costs. It's the department defending the department's PRSI that it should be collecting.
But hang on. That all sounds like a way that you could do this. But falling out of that, you then establish case law.
Well, we have the case law.
But hang on. So you've established, you're saying that this is like, a very real example. I spoke to a meter reader recently who doesn't work for, still not employed by the utilities, who's actually told they have to continue to go into homes to do their jobs. Whereas if you are working directly for the national utility provider, you don't. So there still is that discrepancy in how they are treated and in their terms and conditions several years after the ruling. That's the reality. However, I'm going back to what Brendan is saying. The state aren't going to walk away from this. So if the proposal, as Brendan puts it, is just to say, well, we've got a code of practice. Let's just pile on, and that gives them the cover to, as Mick and you've written about it. You know about the situation where they've mentioned, they've said the words test cases in the Public Accounts Committee. They've said it in the various aspects of things, that like it's on record, so they can still continue to do that as the and no one has to look back retrospectively. Brendan, I see you're shaking your head. What is it? Go on.
Yeah, I am, because I can't have any more proof. I don't think it's possible to have any more proof than on the screen in front of me. How much the government, the Assistant General Secretary of the Department of Social Protection, doesn't want a statutory code of practice than what he has drafted and sent around. Now, there's a reason why they don't want a statutory code of practice. There's a very good reason why. And I don't think we should underplay. First of all, a statutory code of practice is not something that the state has. A statutory code of practice is a piece of law. I use one all the time. If I can give an example, Tony, there's a statutory code of practice which was put in place by Mary Harney in 2002. Not a friend of workers. 2000, actually. Not a friend of workers. It was in the context of a very infamous train dispute, which I may know a little bit about.
Yes, and I remember that, Brendan.
Yeah. The workers at the time had no right to representation. Right. So, but they weren't going to drive trains till they got one. So Mary Harney was forced. She didn't want to do it. She was forced to set down a statutory code of practice, which give workers a right, a limited right, but a right nevertheless, to representation, to call witnesses in individual cases. That became a statutory code of practice that didn't exist and it now exists. I was in the WRC 3 weeks ago. with two dismissed workers that you guys know well in the hospitality and tourism sector. And the employer didn't want to call my right to call witnesses on behalf of those workers. In fact, the employer had sacked the people without witnesses being called. That statutory code of practice was applied in the WRC. The witnesses who didn't come in the internal proceedings before the women were sacked had to come to the WRC, had to give evidence that they should have come, and that's working into the benefit of the women. So a code of practice that was put in place 20 years ago is still being used every day of the week in the WRC. So a code of practice that is signed off by the minister, which takes account of all the legal principles and tests that Martin has been highlighting so well in the work he is doing, would absolutely go to the center of addressing this issue. And that's why Tim Duggan from the department doesn't want one.
Can I quickly just change direction for 1 minute in relation to this and in terms of the overall solutions that might be there? And that is there a complication in that what we might describe as bogus self-employment? Some people might want to be self-employed. Now, to me personally, the biggest issue I see with bogus self-employment is exploitation. Working conditions, people having no security of job, anything like that. I think that's the major decision. I understand there's massive loss of PRSI, but I think the conditions of workers is the major issue. If you take that away, if, for example, you have your chippy on the building site who was going and he's on a job for 6-7 months, he wants to be self-employed as opposed to be employed. It suits him better, probably suits the situation, even if he's one or two working for him. Equally, and somebody mentioned the media, you know, from reports I know through this, is you see the high-profile people in the media work on a contract basis, presumably that's self-employed as well, presenters or whatever. That they'd be two ends of the spectrum. But is there a role for people being self-employed on that basis, even though if you were to have a very strict code of practice, that might fall outside the scope of what self-employment should be?
I'll fail that one. The revenue commissioners were in the PAC before Christmas, and the revenue commissioners were asked a number of questions, which they replied to in February of this year. And one of the big points, and it's a point I've been making for a long time, is the revenue commissioners agreed with my assessment that employment status is not a matter of choice. One must fit the legal criteria. Now, there's very good reason for that. A contract is not just a contract of employment or self-employment or whatever you want to call it. It's not just between two parties. The Department of Social Welfare is a party to that. They're entitled to their PRSI at full whack if that's what they're owed. The revenue commissioners are allowed to collect tax on the basis that somebody is an employee or self-employed. That's what they're owed. So just because two parties, i.e. the employer and the person who's working for the employer, want to avoid tax, that's not a reason to say, well, you can be self-employed. That's not a reason.
I get that. I really do, that there's not just two parties to it. And I think that's fair. But I think Mick makes a good point that there are people in a certain cohort that benefit from the model.
There's no doubt.
Construction in particular, particularly construction industry. Also exploitation, I should say, as well.
Of course there is, and it filters down. But there's also, like in the PAYE sector, there's the special assignee program where you can serve, where you can say, well, this guy's me top man and he's only paying 20%. You know, so we have these loopholes that we do avail of, and it's, you know.
But the end result of that, Tony, and here's the big thing. Are we prepared to sacrifice 2-3 years on pensions so that those who wish to be called self-employed, even though they're employees, can carry on doing that? The cost is your pension. And are you prepared to pay to give up 2-3 years of your pension somebody else can do that?
Well, let's even drop it and bring it to the dinner tables at the moment, where we're being told, you know, we keep hearing that we're going to have austerity in the budget soon. Yeah. When you hear things like that,
a self-employed person typically pays a lot less tax than a person who is an employee. So your tax take is down. They don't pay employers PRSI. So your pension pot is down.
We know all this. Sorry, Brendan, do you want to come in?
Sorry if I came across a bit blunt there, Michael.
Not at all.
I'm certainly joined on the hip with Martin on this one. We have to start in the right place. You might end up in the wrong place if you start in the right place. But if you don't start in the right place, you have no chance. So we need to decide here whether we're talking about worker regulation for the common good in terms of, you know, orderly labour market practices, orderly revenue commission, you know, pensions and all the knock-on effects, or whether we're talking about laissez-faire. Everybody can be and do what they want, whenever they want. We need to make up our minds which we're talking about. They both have things to recommend to them, to the individual, by the way. But if you look at it from the point of view of the common good, we have to look at it as an issue of worker regulation. That's the starting point. It's an issue of worker regulation. And the challenge is to measure in a clear, legally enforceable way the difference between a contract for services and a contract of service, the difference between an employee and a self-employed or bogus self-employed person. We need a clear, legally enforceable way of measuring that. We do not have that at the moment.
One of the recommendations in it, Brendan, is that the Department of Social Protection be given powers to make it costly for employers to deviate and abuse the system. And as we've seen, unfortunately, we don't have a great track record in this country in that. We haven't even...
But making it costly, Tony, is not the same as making it legally enforceable.
I understand that, but
we have to make... Sorry, Tony, I know you. I have to push this home. If whatever is done is not legally enforceable, you can have it as costly as you want. But if the burden is on the employee, if cases aren't taken, if the mechanisms for taking cases are in secret, and all the flaws we have at the moment, it's very, very simple. What are we measuring here? We're measuring the difference between self-employment and employment. How are we going to measure it? If we're not measuring it in a legally enforceable way, let's just stop it. Because it's the Wild West.
So you would be transforming to a large extent the whole method in which the construction industry operates.
Yes. You would, Mick. You'd be transforming to a large extent the extent to which quite a few industries operate. But you're right to point out the construction is one. And you know, some people who benefit, and I would suggest the majority of them in the long term are employers. Employees might think they're making some short-term gains until they discover they've no pension or until they get sick. But in the long term, it's going to cost employers more. That's a fact. It's because it's costing more that the government that they're being incentivized not to do it. So it's going to cost them more, but it's going to have a knock-on effect to the employer, to employee, to their families. But most of all, Mick, and I wouldn't diminish this at all, we're not talking about Mickey Mouse money here. In 1 year, in 2017, they did a test in construction in 2017, and they collected an extra 60 million in just 1 year in just one sector. So we're talking about hundreds of millions here that could be... Now, can anybody tell me any other part of any other experience they have of the revenue commissioners in Ireland having within their power the ability to collect hundreds of millions, and the revenue commissioners aren't insisting on doing so? They're going out to collect tax money of the people that paid the PUP to, for God's sake. And they won't collect taxes for employer taxes of building developers. What sort of country is it?
Brandon is completely right in that. It will transform. Like, construction is the Wild West of the Wild West. It really is. And we've seen, even yesterday, they're talking about having difficulties bringing construction workers back to this country after the lockdown. They've all fecked off to England. Now, you would alleviate problems like that if you made it a proper, steady job. I mean, there was even a case where a young fellow went into revenue to set up a company, and he told them that he was a self-employed apprentice. I mean, that's how nonsense we have gotten in this at the moment. It's utter nonsense. The solution, I mean, as far as the Department of Social Welfare is right, and I see Brandon's, I'm beginning to see Brandon's point on a code of practice, but the code of practice as it exists at the moment is for the shredder. Just get rid of it. It's not making any difference whatsoever. And as we've seen with the recent revelations about RTE and the PAC, despite having a code of practice, despite having 50 years of case law handed down, the rate of bogus self-employment amongst contractors in RTE is at 36%. That's what it's established at. That's astounding. Can you imagine 36% of any tax revenue coming to the state simply being written off because nobody's arse looking for it?
Well, we do it for multinationals, so at an alarming rate. I do want to, I'm actually reminded of the old, I think it was Roosevelt, Nick might correct me, who said, walk soft and carry a big stick. It was actually advice to central bankers, and the reason it came to me is because we're talking about making it changing behaviors here is what in some of the things they'd like to say, and one of the how you change behaviors is you make it difficult and you say, well, there's the big stick. The also one of the other things they used to say is that, you know, don't try not to use the big stick. But I do want to change tact. And Mick, I'd like to ask you just on the spat, because your paper covered it quite extensively between the committee on Department of Social Protection and the Martin's appearance at the PAC. It was kind of unseemly where you had two committees writing to one another saying we have jurisdiction over this. As someone who we've campaigned for CETA to be looked at by as many committees as possible, I just thought, you know, is that really that unusual because it did stand out to me as highly irregular to me that they were writing to one another.
Yeah, well, what struck me about it, Tony, was both of them want to get their teeth into it, and they both seem eager. Now, having said that, I've seen the draft report from the Social Welfare Committee, and getting teeth in, it's not something I would describe as having teeth, to put it that way. It's fairly watery, and you have to wonder whether the PAC will come up with something more robust. But I suppose there'd be an issue if they both produce reports. Where do you go then? So one or the other, but I suppose it's a power play between the two committees on the basis of both of them. Hopefully, see it as a very serious issue that needs to be addressed, and they both want to have a cut. Of course, both of them also, they're vying for the attention of Martin McMahon, which is the main show in town. They both want him before.
There's a big difference, Mick. There's a big difference. The Public Accounts Committee is full of people who are publicly accountable to the election.
So is the Social Welfare Committee.
Well, what I'm looking for from the, and I won't name his name again, but from the Assistant General Secretary of the Department is an attempt. I'm construing it, this union has construed it as an attempt to predetermine the outcome of everything that Martin has shone a light on and to bring this, this forward.
Yeah, that's fair enough, yeah.
And that, now, if I could, that person is not an accountable elected person. So we've got people Martin met on all parties across the political spectrum, but whatever I think of the politics, they're all electorally accountable. So the Public Accounts Committee need to stand up here and do a job.
What I'd say on the committees is I was the second to last witness on the Social Welfare Committee back in 2019. I snuck in under the wire. I gave evidence about the use of test cases. Nobody else who had appeared in there, not revenue, not social welfare, not scope, nobody had said that they are using test cases. Therefore, that committee was misled. Had they known from the very beginning that there was test cases, the entire 8 sessions of that committee would have been entirely different. Entirely different. It took one session within the PAC to establish, yes, there is test cases. Yes, revenue do use them. Now, I went to SIPO and I made a complaint that the department misrepresented itself at that committee. And SIPO came back to me and said that the department had spoken, the CEO of the Department of Social Welfare Appeals Office had spoken erroneously in saying that they don't use test cases. Yet that's not anywhere in the draft report from the committee. And if that's not in the draft report from the committee, well, then bin it, because it's not worth the paper it's written on. If they're not going to address the test cases, if they're going to pretend they don't exist, like they've been doing for 20-odd years, then bin it. It's out of date already.
Martin, do you want to get a bit more roiled up about this? You feel a bit down. You feel a little bit soft.
I get irritated about it, Tony, because we... In the EU, Ireland is the second lowest country in the EU for an employer to hire a worker. In other words, you don't pay much into your social contract. It's very small. Malta is the lowest. We're the second lowest. So employers in Ireland aren't being put under excess pressure to pay into the social contract. And this is what it is. It's the social contract. Each of us pay a bit in according to our means. Workers pay 4%, employers pay up to 11%. If you remove that 11% for employers, you then have no social contract, you then have no services, you then have no social welfare, and your pensions are affected. So I take it very, very seriously.
One thing in relation to the committees, I would say, I take the point about the one thing you can say is that the PSC is a more powerful committee in some sense and might be regarded in that. We've already seen the draft from the Social Welfare Committee, which, as I said, was very watery. And where this is really important is that without a strong report from whichever committee going to government, there is no hope of the political will to change things. Whatever chance there is, if a government can turn around and say, well, we're going according to what was decided at the All-Party Oireachtas Committee, blah, 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 then there's no hope of getting it changed. Without a strong report, that is dependent on which committee it comes from. As I say, I wouldn't have strong views on which one, but we've already seen the Social Welfare Committee, and that is certainly not a strong report. So therefore, you have to hope that whatever comes out of the PAC is more robust in that sense.
And the PAC is the only one with statutory powers.
Martin, we have to wrap this up. We have to wrap this up. Brendan, final thoughts.
Yeah, I know there's a little bit of banter going on there between you and Martin, who are really good friends. But I want to make a serious point about it, Tony. And I know you'll agree with me on this. Martin is passionate because he's a whistleblower. And that's effectively what he is, whether he calls himself that or not, that's what he is. And he's been pursuing this issue for many, many years. And whistleblowers, by their very nature, are speaking truth to power. And that's a really difficult thing to do. And it's a really difficult thing to do in this country. I imagine it's a really difficult thing to do anywhere. It's certainly a difficult thing to do here. And you can only do it if you're as stubborn, as rambunctious, as determined, and sometimes, and Martin, you know I love you, as bloody annoying as Martin is.
Yeah, that's true.
I hope that whatever comes out of the social welfare, and we're not optimistic, whatever comes out of the Public Accounts Committee, even if it's bad, I hope Martin continues to do what he's been doing, continues to be stubborn, rambunctious and annoying, and continues to speak truth to power, because we need an awful lot more of that. We just have a slight difference in what we can do. But Martin, I look forward to continuing to talk to you about that.
Oh, yeah, absolutely, Brendan. We're on the same side. We want better conditions for workers. That's what we're looking for.
I think we leave it there, folks. Mick, do you have any?
Well, I mean, for once, and I know this would probably be earth-shattering news all over the world, I'm in complete agreement with Brendan Olden.
We'll edit that out. That was worth doing a pod for.
Nick Clifford, Brendan Ogle and Martin McMahon, thanks for joining us to have this conversation. As I said earlier, if you're listening, we will be back shortly. There is a report into the drug gangs in Ballymun that we'll be recovering. We'll be covering later. And Rory has a housing shock pod with Mr. Crazy House Prices, I believe his name is he's going by. So we'll have plenty more coming. Keep an eye on that feed. There's lots coming at you. Bye bye.
Tony and Martin, Martin and Tony, speaking to interesting people only. It's the Echo Chamber podcast. Subscribe now on Patreon.